Hello and welcome to Sound Body, a weekly program of information on health topics and ideas that can help you live life to its fullest. I'm Louise Craig. I always like reading medical mysteries. Of course, I enjoy the kind of TV show like Dr. House, where everything is solved in under an hour and no one leaves without a diagnosis. But the kind of medical mysteries that Sandra G. Boodman of the Washington Post reports on reflect the real world, where it can take a long time to get a diagnosis and it isn't always a happy ending. Although it seems pretty universal that people find some relief in just getting a diagnosis. We're going to read two of Ms. Boodman's medical mysteries today, starting with one from December 15th of 2018, titled, A Fitness Fanatic Runs Into an Alarming Ailment That Was Caught in the Nick of Time. Barry Goldsmith went to great lengths to stay out of the doctor's office. His belief in the power of exercise, particularly running, to keep him fit and healthy, had long been an article of faith. If he wasn't feeling well, Goldsmith would lace up his shoes and run it off. The Maryland patent lawyer routinely racked up about 30 miles per week, more when he was training for a marathon or triathlon, interspersed with swimming, cycling, and weight training. For more than 30 years, his strategy worked. Barry is incredibly fit, and he's always been this major athlete to avoid seeing doctors, said his wife Paula, a former teacher. His aversion persisted even after his sister became a family physician. But several years ago, Goldsmith, now 56, experienced a series of alarming episodes he couldn't outrun. They followed a pattern. First, a rush of what felt like acid would shoot up Goldsmith's legs. Then came 10 minutes or so of pounding heart palpitations that ended with a wave of nausea. At first, the episodes were sporadic, but eventually they increased in frequency and duration, leaving Goldsmith crumpled on a neighbor's lawn at the start of a run. The couple were shocked to discover that Goldsmith's problem was potentially fatal and had been germinating for years, partly camouflaged by his stellar level of fitness. Being in good physical health was a blessing and a curse, Goldsmith said recently. The longer I waited, the more I put myself at risk. Goldsmith first noticed the problem in 2014 at the end of a cross-country flight. Landing in California, he stood up and felt the rush of acid, palpitations, and nausea, which subsided fairly quickly. Maybe, Goldsmith remembers thinking, he'd been sitting too long. When the episodes recurred every month or so, he found them concerning, but for months did not mention them to his wife or his internist, whom he saw every year or so. In 2015, he developed occasional morning headaches. Goldsmith consulted the cardiologist he'd seen as a precaution for a low heart rate, which can result from vigorous exercise, but did not mention the episodes. The doctor said that Goldsmith appeared to be healthy. He told me, "I'm fine now. I cleared it," Paula recalled, and kept pushing. By 2016, the morning headaches were occurring more often. At times, Goldsmith felt tired, but assumed he was getting older or hadn't slept well. "We both just kind of ignored it," Paula said. Nothing intensified, and most days he was fine. But during a 5K race in July 2017, Goldsmith felt so weak he had to stop midway and walk to the finish line. The palpitations and nausea were more frequent. Goldsmith called his sister, who suggested he see an endocrinologist. Some of their relatives had thyroid problems. Perhaps he did, too. The endocrinologist he saw in September ordered blood tests, which revealed a slightly sluggish thyroid. During the visit, Goldsmith mentioned in passing the running problem, which hadn't recurred, and his morning headaches. The endocrinologist suggested he might want to try thyroid medication and recommended that he return in 3 months. By late fall, Goldsmith was having more trouble completing a run. His headaches had become a near daily event. An ophthalmologist friend suggested that he might be experiencing blood pressure spikes, even though his readings in doctor offices were normal. That made sense. Both his parents had developed mild hypertension in their 60s. At his friend's suggestion, Goldsmith bought a blood pressure cuff. He immediately suspected the device was malfunctioning. The readings at times were off the charts, so high they couldn't possibly be accurate, he thought. One registered 204 over 118, a reading consistent with a hypertensive crisis, which can require emergency treatment. At other times, they were normal, about 125 over 85. Goldsmith tried using a friend's cuff. The same thing happened. Despite Paula's increasing insistence that he call his doctor, Goldsmith waited a month. He said he wanted to see if the reading stabilized. I kept pushing, but he fought all of it, she recalled. He downplayed everything. That was his style, a characterization with which Goldsmith agrees. In December, Goldsmith acceded to his wife's wishes and saw one of his internist's partners. His blood pressure reading in the office was a worrisome 170 over 87. Goldsmith told the doctor, who prescribed medicine to reduce his blood pressure, that he was switching jobs and under a lot of stress. Goldsmith took the medicine faithfully, but the spikes continued. In January 2018, Goldsmith returned to the endocrinologist, accompanied by Paula. He mentioned the blood pressure spikes and headaches. The specialist ordered blood tests to check Goldsmith's hormone levels and convinced him to start taking a low dose of medicine for his underactive thyroid. As they were leaving the office, Paula suggested they stop at the lab downstairs for the tests the endocrinologist had ordered. Goldsmith demurred. He hated needles. His internist had recently increased the dose of his blood pressure drug, and he said he wanted to see if the new regimen worked before getting the blood tests. But the increased dose of blood pressure medicine, later augmented by a second drug, made him feel worse. And Goldsmith had developed a new symptom, profuse sweating. Keeping close track of his blood pressure, he had noticed a pattern. Shortly after waking up, when he had a headache, his blood pressure was usually sky high. An hour later, it returned to normal. At that point, he took his blood pressure medicine, went for a run, and took another reading. It was an alarmingly low 83 over 48, and Goldsmith typically felt weak and spent, fearful that he might pass out. But in a few hours, the reading returned to normal. Doctors told him that calibrating the proper dose of blood pressure medication can be tricky and suggested he change the timing. In May, things fell apart. During a run with friends, Goldsmith stopped after less than a mile. He then vomited and sank onto a neighbor's lawn, too weak to stand. Paula arrived minutes later. By then, he seemed to have recovered somewhat. She remembers feeling furious and terrified. I said, this is not working. You're damaging your heart. You need to find a blood pressure specialist, she remembered. Goldsmith went online to see what he could learn about the causes of blood pressure spikes. References to a rare, typically benign tumor of the adrenal gland called pheochromocytoma kept popping up. The symptoms sounded familiar. Sudden hypertension or blood pressure spikes, profuse sweating, rapid heart rate, weakness, and headaches. These result when the tumor releases uncontrolled bursts of hormones, including adrenaline, particularly in response to physical exertion or stress. Adrenal hormones help control many functions, including heart rate, metabolism, blood pressure, and response to stress. Goldsmith emailed his internist and asked if it was possible that he had such a tumor, known in medical jargon as a pheo. The internist replied that it was and told him to call the endocrinologist. A week later, he was back in her office. The doctor told him that one of the blood tests she had ordered 6 months earlier, which he had not gotten, could have helped answer this question. It measured the level of catecholamines, hormones secreted by the adrenal glands, the paired organs atop the kidneys. Elevated levels of these hormones can signal an endocrine tumor. Goldsmith's levels turned out to be far above normal. The endocrinologist sent him for an abdominal CT scan, which revealed an enormous tumor, roughly the dimensions of a small acorn squash, engulfing his right adrenal gland. It was probably a pheo, about 10% of which are malignant. The tumors, which are diagnosed in about 2 of every 1,000,000 adults annually in the United States, are rarely the cause of high blood pressure, accounting for 0.2% of hypertension cases. Pheos often develop for unknown reasons, but in at least 25% of cases, genetic factors play a role. Doctors consider the tumors a time bomb. They can cause a stroke, kidney failure, heart attack, or a sudden unexplained death. Treatment typically involves surgery to remove the tumor, along with the affected adrenal gland. Goldsmith's endocrinologist immediately called Washington endocrine surgeon Aaron Felger. Felger, associate program director of general surgery at MedStar Washington Hospital Center, met with the couple 2 days later. The size of Goldsmith's slow-growing tumor, 10 centimeters, made laparoscopic removal a challenge that would require 2 surgeons, she told the Goldsmiths. It's clear he's had it for many years, Felger said. Although frightened by the prospect of surgery and the risk of sudden death posed by such a tumor, Goldsmith said he was reassured by Felger's experience, her straightforward manner, and by the fact that she, too, was a runner. Felger, who has performed more than 250 such surgeries, ticked off possible complications, which include postoperative heart problems and blood loss requiring a transfusion. Goldsmith first needed to take drugs to stabilize his blood pressure, which could shoot up significantly during the operation. For Paula, the 2-week pre-op period crawled by, dominated by the specter of her husband's sudden death. Every morning, she said, she awoke wondering whether he was still alive. I didn't want to leave his side, she recalled. Felger said that the June 29th procedure went perfectly. He was scheduled to spend 2 days in the intensive care unit and a total of 5 days in the hospital, but Goldsmith was well enough to be discharged the day after his surgery. 6 weeks later, with Felger's approval, Goldsmith resumed running, although initially at a slower pace and a reduced distance. His blood pressure remains slightly elevated, which is common after surgery. He will require lifelong monitoring to make sure the tumor doesn't recur, which is rarely the case. In the months before his diagnosis, Goldsmith said, fear was an obstacle. He was increasingly afraid of what doctors might find. In retrospect, he wishes he'd acted with greater dispatch. I could have saved a few years, he said. Our next Washington Post medical mystery, she couldn't stop coughing. Were fragrances to blame? Vicki Harwood was sick of feeling like an outcast. For nearly 6 months beginning last July, Harwood had been sequestered in an office by herself, far removed from the large room full of cubicles where her coworkers sat. Being alone in an office with a fan running and the door closed seemed to be the only way to quell her uncontrollable coughing fits triggered by perfume or other strong fragrances. Harwood worried that some of her colleagues might be skeptical about what appeared to be a dramatic worsening of the adult onset asthma with which she'd been diagnosed 20 years earlier. I felt like the girl in the bubble, said Harwood, 61, who lives in Phoenix. Because desk assignments at the giant consulting firm where she works as an administrative assistant are based on rank, private offices are reserved for senior managers, Harwood worried that her colleagues suspected she might be milking her illness to secure an office. Several made it clear they were put off by the measures she took to avoid a coughing fit. People would get offended if I had to stand away from them while having a conversation, she recalled. Although doctors initially assumed her asthma was to blame, Harwood would discover that her cough was caused by something else entirely. Once you have a diagnosis in place, everyone just kind of rolls with that, she said. In 1994, Harwood, then living in the San Francisco area, began feeling winded when she spoke. Two decades earlier, Harwood, who took voice lessons and sang at weddings and in amateur musicals, had undergone surgery to remove benign polyps from her vocal cords after she strained her voice. Through vocal therapy sessions, she'd learned proper technique and had avoided a recurrence. Her first thought was that new polyps had formed. She saw a respiratory specialist who performed a series of tests. The doctor told her that there was no sign of new polyps. He said, "I really can't figure out what's wrong with you, so by process of elimination, we'll call it asthma." She remembers the doctor telling her, although it wasn't clear what was causing it. But the doctor seemed convinced, so she began using the asthma inhaler he prescribed. Around the same time, Harwood faced an equally pressing problem. She had developed a hiatal hernia that was causing a severe form of heartburn known as gastroesophageal reflux disease, or GERD. The hernia, which can occur as a result of an anatomical defect, pregnancy, or obesity, causes the stomach to slide up into the esophagus when a person swallows, resulting in burning pain in the chest. To ease her symptoms, a gastroenterologist told Harwood to sleep on an incline, not flat on her back. He prescribed an acid-blocking drug that at $300 per month and not covered by her insurance, Harwood took only sporadically. For the next 20 years, she had few problems with either asthma or GERD, but in the spring of 2014, her insurer informed her that it would no longer pay for her long-time asthma medicine. Her internist prescribed a different inhaler, which was covered under her plan. A few weeks after she began taking the new drug, Harwood started coughing soon after she arrived at work. "It was like a continuous tickling in my throat," she recalled. After 2 hours, her lungs felt raw, and Harwood was short of breath and exhausted. The problem recurred with increasing frequency, and Harwood suspected that the perfumed body lotion she wore was responsible. She stopped wearing it, but noticed that other fragrances had the same effect. Oddly, she didn't cough much outside the office unless she got a whiff of a strong scent. Harwood also felt unusually fatigued. By lunchtime, she felt so tired she could barely put one foot in front of the other and complete her 30-minute exercise walk. Her once refreshing after-work swim became a slog. The fatigue reminded Harwood of how she had felt in 2009 when she developed walking pneumonia, a milder form of the lung infection. Her internist at the time had chided her for not using her inhaler regularly because asthma can worsen pneumonia. Harwood explained that she used it only sporadically because she couldn't see that the drug was making a difference. "The doctor told me that asthma was a chronic condition and that I was no spring chicken and therefore more susceptible to these respiratory illnesses," she recalled. She began taking the medicine every day. In late July, after several weeks of coughing, Harwood decamped to a spare office used by out-of-town employees. She kept the door closed and a fan running, and after a few days felt much better. Perhaps she thought the new asthma drug was responsible for her sudden sensitivity to fragrances. Harwood returned to the internist, who agreed that the medicine didn't seem to be working. The doctor requested an exemption from Harwood's insurer, which was quickly granted. She resumed taking her old asthma medicine, this time at a higher dose. "I thought, okay, now I'll be fine." She wasn't. The coughing returned, and Harwood grew increasingly worried about keeping her job. "I knew I couldn't stay in that office forever," she said, "and I thought, oh my God, what am I going to do?" By this time, she'd grown so sensitive to fragrances that her husband had to stop wearing deodorant or cologne. Once, when he forgot, her coughing was so bad that the couple had to make the 15-minute drive to work with the car windows down, wilting in the triple-digit Arizona heat. "This was really starting to bother me," Harwood said. "How do you live in a world where fragrance is in everything?" In late August, Harwood consulted an asthma specialist. After a battery of tests, the doctor told her he thought her cough was not triggered by asthma, but by GERD, asthma and GERD sometimes coexist, although doctors are unsure of the relationship between the two conditions. He recommended that she consult her gastroenterologist and faithfully take her acid-blocking drug, which was now cheaper and available over the counter. A few weeks later, and no better despite the acid blocker, Harwood was worried that she had damaged her lungs, so she decided to see a lung specialist before calling her gastroenterologist. She tried to explain to her co-workers that she was having an asthma problem that was proving hard to control. On November 18th, she saw pulmonologist Eleanor Schottsted, who zeroed in on the raspy quality of Harwood's voice and asked her why she was repeatedly clearing her throat. Harwood replied that someone on the bus she'd taken to the doctor's office had been wearing perfume, triggering her cough. Schottsted said she was immediately suspicious when Harwood told her of the diagnosis of adult-onset asthma. "That's atypical," Schottsted said, "and when it occurs, I want an explanation for it. She has no allergies characteristic of asthma, nor did she have any wheezing." Harwood's description of an instantaneous reaction to fragrances, the pulmonologist said, seemed less indicative of a lung problem like asthma than of a laryngospasm, a sudden, brief spasm affecting the vocal cords that makes it difficult to speak. The doctor noted Harwood's long history of acid reflux and her complaints of fatigue when she awoke, neither of which typifies asthma. Schottsted suspected that Harwood had a condition called vocal cord dysfunction, VCD, not asthma. The misdiagnosis is common. In fact, the two conditions can coexist, although in Harwood's case they did not. There is no evidence that Harwood ever had asthma. VCD occurs when the vocal cords do not open correctly because the vocal muscles tighten, making breathing difficult and causing a feeling of breathlessness. Coughing is a common symptom, and unlike people with asthma, which causes problems breathing out, VCD sufferers find it more difficult to breathe in. GERD can exacerbate or trigger VCD, as can inhaling smoke or strong odors, including fragrances. Chronic cough and frequent throat clearing can further irritate the vocal cords. The first description of VCD dates back to 1951, when it was dubbed factitious asthma. Doctors essentially thought patients were lying. 3 decades later, a team of specialists at National Jewish Health in Denver outlined effective treatment, which includes controlling acid reflux, speech therapy to relax the vocal muscles, and techniques to suppress coughing and to combat stress are often recommended. In some cases, several days of complete voice rest are required to allow the vocal cords to begin to heal. To confirm her suspicion, Schottsted ordered a video stroboscopy, a test that uses rapid bursts of light to inspect the movement of the vocal cords. The test revealed that Harwood's vocal cords were not functioning properly, confirming Schottsted's diagnosis. Schottsted also said she suspected that Harwood might have obstructive sleep apnea. Although Harwood is fit and not overweight, unlike many people with sleep apnea, she snored and her sleep was not restorative. Both are characteristic of sleep apnea, in which loud snoring is followed repeatedly by a brief cessation of breathing, causing a person to awaken repeatedly. The condition, which results when the muscles at the back of the throat relax improperly, is a risk factor for heart attack and stroke. After testing revealed a mild case of sleep apnea, Harwood began using a portable device called a CPAP machine at home, which she said improved her sleep. She also began taking a stronger acid-blocking medication prescribed by her gastroenterologist, who advised her to reduce GERD by not eating for 3 hours before bedtime. At Schottsted's recommendation, Harwood also underwent several speech therapy sessions to help improve the functioning of her vocal cords. The crucial test occurred in January after several weeks of treatment. Harwood returned from a 2-week Christmas break and sat at her own cubicle for the first time in months, braced for what might happen. "It went perfectly," she said. "Other than an occasional cough, Harwood said she feels fine. Her sensitivity to fragrances has diminished to the point that she can even wear perfume again, although she dabs it sparingly on her ankles." Harwood is grateful for Schottstedt's expertise and glad to be back with her co-workers. The biggest thing that makes me angry is being told I had asthma and taking medicine I didn't need for 20 years. And I forgot to tell you that that was from the July 27th, 2015 Washington Post. Sandra G. Boodman has been writing this column for quite a while. We have a few little pieces here from the Discover Magazine special issue, September 2018, Medical Mysteries. And the first is, what percentage of diagnoses are wrong? 5% or less? 10% to 30%? 30% to 50%? 50% or more? According to a review of several studies, anywhere from 10 to 30% of errors are errors of diagnosis. But don't rush to blame the doctor. Many conditions elude conclusive diagnosis. You can narrow the odds by giving your doctor as many specifics about your symptoms as you can and better understand the ramifications of a diagnosis by asking these questions. Please explain my diagnosis. What symptoms or facts about my case led you to that diagnosis? What does this condition mean for my overall health? Will it affect my daily routine? Is there anything I can do to control or manage the condition or its symptoms? What are my treatment options? What are the benefits or side effects of these options? Will I need surgery? Please explain the procedure. Who will perform it? How often has that person performed it? Does my condition have to be treated? What are the consequences if I don't get it treated? Do you recommend further tests to confirm the diagnosis? What are these tests for? What will they tell us? What are the benefits of seeking a second opinion? How can I find out more information about this condition or disease? Are there any clinical trials underway for this condition or disease? And I am going to keep this list myself because it may seem self-evident, but I think when you're about to face surgery, you probably, or surgery or any new medication or diagnosis, I think it's hard to remember to ask what led you to that diagnosis? What else do I need to know? So I hope that's been helpful today. Thank you for tuning in to Sound Body. Stay well, and please come back next week for more healthy living ideas. This has been Sound Body, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. I'm Louise Craig, and I hope you'll join me again next week for more health updates and information for healthy living. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can download a podcast of the show at our website, wxxi.org.